Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
And a very warm welcome back to Solidarity Breakfast.
A left response to the major developments in capitalism.
What they trade in is not wheat. They trade in famine.
A little dose of revolutionary optimism.
I think it's really important to sort of express solidarity globally.
It really is a deal by corporations for corporations.
The union forever defending our rights, down with the black leg.
If you think the ABC's left wing, don't listen to this program.
Solidarity Breakfast, 7:30 to 9 a.m. Saturdays, 3CR, 8:55 a.m. Streaming and 3CR digital, podcast or audio on demand. And of course, the website, solidaritybreakfast.org.au.
Solidarity forever!
Good morning, everybody. Annie here.
And Anila.
And Tobia. Good morning.
Yes, and it is a nice morning out there. I think we've folded ourselves into a sort of an Indian summer or something over the last few days in Melbourne. But just watch out. It'll probably turn into torrential rain, cold and bitter, but not at the moment. It's quite nice out there.
You heard it here first from Annie, our local nationalist.
That's right, because I get to ride here early in the morning, and there's more people are out there at 5 o'clock in the morning than you'd expect. Someone actually said good morning to me as I rode past.
Yeah, I know, the birds are up earlier.
I know, they were screeching. Yeah, that's right. Anyway, we've got things to talk about. Some things
It's important, though, to have the Solidarity Breakfast morning weather update. Yeah.
All right, so we'll start off with some appalling stuff to do with Israel.
Yeah, the Israeli military overnight massacred over 104 people on Tuesday and Wednesday, it was reported, in a series of attacks throughout the Gaza Strip, demonstrating the complete fraud of the ceasefire adopted on October 10th. The attacks killed 46 children and 20 women and injured over 200 people, according to Gaza's health ministry. And on Tuesday, the office of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said that a decision had been made to, quote, to immediately carry out forceful strikes in the Gaza Strip, and that US President Trump was informed before the action was taken.
Oh, wow, that's okay then.
Yeah, well, it's got the head honcho's approval. The Israeli military boasted that it carried out a series of strikes in which dozens of what they deemed terror targets and terrorists were struck.
What, they killed themselves?
Well, we also saw this series of language being used in Venezuela, where less and less credible targets are being hit. And we'll hear something that you recorded last week at the U.S. out of Venezuela rally. On Tuesday, Trump declared that if Hamas does not behave, that they're going to be terminated and that their lives will be terminated.
Oh, well, that's interesting because on a more local note, Uncle Robbie Thorpe has taken the Hamas designation as a terrorist organisation within the Australian context to court.
Yeah. Much to the dismay of Zionist shills Alex Rivchin, who was appalled by the decision. But actually, Uncle Robbie Thorpe's case is pretty in line with international law, saying that the prescribing of a political organization is actually limiting to freedom of speech and the freedom to report. How do we carry out our job if we can't even tell the truth or report on it?
I think the other kind of regional update that I've had my eye on this week was Lebanon's president, Joseph Aoun, escalating Lebanese responses to Israeli aggression. Aoun this week instructed the Lebanese army to, quote, confront any future incursions by Israeli ground troops following an incursion into the Lebanese border town of Blida this week. And also as a result of that incursion, the killing of a municipal employee. And this signals a pretty big shift in Lebanon's approach or response to Israeli aggression. Before this point, they have largely kind of let slide any kind of overt attacks, and I mean, dare I say, invasion. They've let slide, and this, I think, for a lot of people, has signaled that the likelihood of having a face-to-face clash between the two states is becoming increasingly more likely.
Well, this business about it being called the IDF as opposed to the IOF, the Israeli Defense Force as opposed to the Israeli Offensive Force.
Well, I'll be interested to see how much this Lebanese PM's move to do this is actually a move to delegitimize Hezbollah's military attacks and try and remove some of their power from the south of Lebanon, and if it's a bigger regional play, because this is a president that was largely supported by Trump's special envoy to the Middle East.
So you're pointing out that the internal politics is not what it seems necessarily. You also were aware of some things going on in Sudan.
Yeah, so there's been big developments in the civil war in Sudan. So this week, El Fasher in Sudan's west was seized by the paramilitary group Rapid Support Forces, or the RSF. In the aftermath of the transfer of control from the Sudanese government to the RSF, thousands of civilians fled their homes and thousands more remain trapped in El Fasher. Sudan's Doctors Network has reported that in the first 3 days after capturing El Fasher, the RSF killed at least 1,500 people, including 460 patients at their companions from the local Al Saud hospital, which, as we know, is against international law. Elsewhere in Sudan's North Kordofan state, increasing violence against civilians has been reported, leading 4,500 people to flee the state and to the killing of 5 Sudanese Red Crescent Society volunteers in Bara. Since the beginning of Sudan's civil war in 2023, 150,000 people have died.
And a lot of these factions don't enjoy any real popular support. The RSF is funded largely in part to the United Arab Emirates. And the devastation's not just on people's lives, on the human patrimony. There's some of the biggest archaeological finds in human history are in Sudan, some of the biggest relics. And the Minister for Archaeology, or a head researcher, I'm forgetting her name now, but she's had to flee to Scotland, and she was saying that the biggest museum in Sudan has actually been looted, and some of the biggest relics of human history. It's not just Sudanese.
No, that's exactly right. If you know a little, I mean, I've done just a little bit of a look at the various civilizations in Africa, and they are incredible and extraordinary. We just have a general European-centric view of the world, and maybe even a tiny little bit of an understanding of Asian dynasties, but the African dynasties are quite extraordinary. Many of these wars underline the fact that these are resources wars. These are resources wars. And if you want to get an overview of why this present system that we live in is not much interested in human rights, you should catch the thing that was played on 3CR just before the breakfast on Friday. It was Noam Chomsky from 1980s, or 86, I think, and it was from the Alternative Radio Vault, and it was just an overview of where American imperialism and capitalism is going. I mean, it was written in 1986, but I'm sure it was old news even then.
you know, on the topic of American imperialism, I think we'd be remiss not to mention this gobsmacking headline. Maybe shouldn't be gobsmacking at this point. But the Pentagon told Congress this week that it does not know the identities of the 61 people that have been extrajudicially killed in strikes near Venezuela and in the Eastern Pacific Ocean. So, yeah, bald-faced, no attempt to justify the killings of literally random people. International crisis group's Phil Gunson says, quote, the U.S. pursuing further military action and regime change risks creating anarchy and fueling violent struggles for territory among Venezuela's many armed groups, which have a vested interest in maintaining the status quo. So business as usual in the American
and
empire.
And not the good kind of anarchy.
No.
But there have been some independent journalist outlets that have reported, especially in the Caribbean, have interviewed families of the fishermen that have been killed in those strikes, that were saying, they have a really chilling quote that the family of one of the fishermen was saying that this is Trump is just killing poor people.
Yeah.
Well, I think killing people that no one is going to make enough of a fuss about for it to cause them any real problems.
Well, it's interesting because I was picking up some stories from Cultural Survival, which is an online voice for Indigenous people, extraordinary actual reportage from Cultural Survival. And this one was about Ecuador, because there's Ecuador's Indigenous resistance, a journey through El Paro. The plan was straightforward, travel to Ecuador's Intag region in Imbabura province to interview a resistance leader who had successfully expelled a mining company from his territory, says Brandy Moran, who's the writer. He's a Cree Iroquois reporter that reports for Cultural Survival. But on September the 28th, 2025, as my team and I prepared for the seven-hour journey north from our starting point, we quickly learned that nothing about covering social movements in Ecuador would be simple. El Paro, the national strike called by the Confederation of Indigenous Nationalities of Ecuador, had transformed the country's roads into front lines of resistance. El Paro, which translates simply as the strike, represents far more than a labour stoppage. It is a constitutionally protected form of collective action in Ecuador, rooted in the indigenous right to resistance against policies that threaten their survival and territorial sovereignty. Called by CONAIT on September the 22nd, following President Daniel Noboa's elimination of diesel subsidies through Decree 126, the mobilisation united Indigenous communities, farmers and social organisations across Ecuador's northern and central Andean regions in a coordinated uprising that would bring entire provinces to a standstill. The diesel decree was merely the breaking point. The demands encompass the reduction of value-added taxes that have increased months earlier, revocation of environmental licenses for extractive projects threatening Indigenous territories, an end to criminalisation and persecution of land defenders, increased government investment in health and education, and justice for activists detained during mobilisation. Most urgently, they sought accountability for the murder of 46-year-old Kishwa land defender Efrain Furriez from Contcachi, who has been shot and killed by the Ecuadorian military on September the 28th while protesting in Imbabura. It goes on to talk about a whole range of things that are going on in Ecuador and the struggle for Indigenous rights within an extractivist capitalist system.
Yeah, we'll link the whole article on the podcast page so you can read it for yourself. And I mean, coming a bit closer... Sorry, go, Anila.
Well, I think before we move on from headlines, We better mention that.
Yeah, the fairly important thing.
On Thursday, treaty legislation passed in Victoria's Parliament. So, in an Australian first, the bill will enshrine a democratically elected body for First Nations peoples in the Victorian legislature, as well as establishing a treaty between First Nations peoples within Victoria and the Victorian state government. The bill will also establish a permanent assembly known as Gelengwol, which means, quote, tip of the spear or pointed spear in Ganaikanai language. So, a bit of positive news for the week.
Yeah, I was only going to come back home to talk about the media release that the Refugee Action Coalition had released about stopping the racist deportation and calling for an end to Australia's gulag and to close Nauru, because the Australian Labor government has doubled down on its legislation that would see thousands of non-people, so-called non-citizens, deported to Nauru not only at massive cost to taxpayers, but also at massive emotional cost to the families and people involved, mm-hmm. who would be forcibly removed from their living situations and now I'm getting stuck between two words, but stuck in Nauru for the rest of their lives.
Yeah, indefinitely.
Indefinitely detained. The announcement that the first NZYQ deportee has successfully been sent to Nauru has opened a new era of Labor government-facilitated human rights abuses. The Refugee Action Coalition is calling on the government to stop the deportations of refugees and so-called non-citizens to Nauru, and to finally put an end to its neo-colonial practice of using Nauru as an offshore prison island.
You know, that's interesting, because there's a whole range of things that are coming out about the Albanese government lately. The Centre for Public Integrity undertook a review of the record for integrity from the Albanese government, because, you know, they're all wearing suits and they're all business as usual and everybody's acting like, you know, they're a competent government. But their commitment to transparency, this is part of a report that's been put out by the Centre for Public Integrity, and we'll put the link for that. Commitment to transparency leading to a culture of secrecy. The Freedom of Information Bill, Amendment Bill 2025, introduces alarming rollbacks, expanding exemptions, reintroducing fees, and banning anonymous requests. They go on to cronyism, more jobs for mates. The 2023 Briggs Review into public sector appointments remains withheld. Public appointments continue without adequate guardrails and transparencies, and new major public offices are being created without merit-based appointment provisions. Undue influence. Glaring loopholes in Australia's lobbying regime persist while the government blocks scrutiny of ministerial diaries and political fundraising links, supporting Parliament and its accountability functions. Scrutiny weakens. Staff cuts to the opposition following last term's cuts to the Independents, removal of the Indigenous Affairs Estimates Day, and exemptions from parliamentary review weaken security and transparency. The FOI Bill 2025 expands secrecy while ignoring key 3D report recommendations to strengthen independence and reform departmental appointments, as well as protecting whistleblowers. The draft Whistleblower Protection Bill 2025 is a welcome start, but fails to guarantee independence, resources and accessibility for those who speak up. It goes on to this is different things, but it's coming. It's another part of the nuance around the Albanese government's performance. There's been a joint statement put out by civil society groups who call on the government to abandon police power to stop Centrelink payments without proper judicial process. The government's last minute amendments to the legislation around Centrelink payments enables police to advise the Home Affairs Minister to stop a person's Centrelink payment if there is a warrant for their arrest in relation to a serious crime. It affects people receiving any income support payment, including parenting payment, paid parental leave and family tax benefit, meaning it can deprive people and children who are not accused of any crime of money they need to live. And Anglicare Australia Executive Director Casey Chambers says this proposal is completely at odds with the principle of fairness and justice. Cutting off someone's income before they have been found guilty of any crime is punishment without conviction. We should not have to explain why it is. This has no place in a fair society. This is a shocking overreach of police powers in the social security system. We've seen too many times what happens when governments rush through changes without thinking through the consequences. Robo-debt should have been warning enough. We're calling on the government to withdraw these amendments and commit to a system that upholds people's rights and dignity, not ones that tear them away.
It just makes you wonder, like, whose bright idea was that? Who couldn't think for more than 5 seconds about the implications of doing something like that?
But also, they've probably thought about that and that they're happy that that is the outcome. And, I mean, this is a Labor government that is strong-worded in opposition, but actually much worse than Scott Morrison in power.
Well, yeah, that's right. They're all in suits and it all looks like they're competent. They just on Digital Rights Watch tells us that workers in the creative industry should be pleased with the federal government ruling out a text and data mining exemption that would allow big tech companies to steal their work in order to feed AI training systems. But the rest of us are still left wanting. The head of their policy group says a TDM exemption was one of many ideas floated in the Productivity Commission's Data and Digital Interim Report that centred around a let-it-rip model of leaving AI companies largely unregulated. Denying this exemption repudiates this model and opens the door for much-needed and stronger regulation for tech, big tech and their AI systems. 86% of Australians want to see more regulation of AI companies. So let's hope that actually happens.
Yeah, and we'll go now to Sydney, where Vivian Langford from the Climate Action Show, which you can catch on Mondays at 5 p.m. She's always contributing some of the best material from Sydney and keeping up the link to see how the struggles are united, not just on the eastern seaboard, but across. We'll listen to David Shoebridge now as he spoke on the Sydney rally of the 26th of October.
All right, on that, I've got more to say about weapons expo that Romy had just talked about. But before I get to that, I'm going to invite up David Shoebridge to come and speak to us. He's, of course, a Green senator, staunch supporter of this campaign for the past 2 years. Thank you, David.
Thanks very much, Josh. I want to start by acknowledging this land is and always will be Aboriginal land. It's Gadigal land we're on. Gadigal land. This is Gadigal land. Thanks so much for everyone coming out today. And I too want to kick off by giving a shout out to Rising Tide, making those connections between fossil fuel industry and the corporations that want to screw our planet through carbon and the corporations that want to screw our planet through weapons. So thanks very much for Rising Tide for their action today and the right-wing media who attacked them and promoted their rally day after day. But we're gathering here today, what, more than 2 years after this genocide started, and it's pretty hard to be shocked by our government, but I was shocked that they had the brazenness that just in the last few weeks to sign another arms contract with an Israeli weapons manufacturer. You know, Albanese's signature on yet another contract, another $20 million to Elbit Systems, which follows on from a $900 million contract they gave them in February of 2024. $1 billion plus of our money going to an Israeli weapons manufacturer that right now is making record profits from a genocide. I mean, what kind of moral low has Federal Labor sunk to when they think that they can just put that in our face at this time in history? And of course, there's been over $1 billion worth of contracts that this government has signed with Israeli weapons manufacturers since the genocide started. And in just over a week, commencing on the 4th of November, there's going to be Israeli weapons manufacturers in Sydney trying to sell their wares again. At an expo in Sydney, funded and supported by the Chris Minns Labor government in Macquarie Street. They're literally spending our tax dollars to invite the global harm industry to come here and sell their weapons. What part of genocide do these people not understand? What part of obscenity do they not understand? And I've been to those weapons fairs. I'm the Federal Greens spokesperson for defence and foreign affairs, so part of my job is to go to those weapons fairs and see for myself, to do some truth testing. And I've seen Elbit Systems stands and Rafael defence industry stands and other Israeli weapons manufacturer stands, and do you know what they do when they're selling their equipment? They show videos of their missiles and their tanks and their software being deployed in Gaza. And they literally show snuff videos of their weapons killing people in Gaza and killing people in Lebanon and killing people in Yemen. And then they say to the likes of Richard Marles and Anthony Albanese, they say to them, look, you see, our weapons are battle tested. You should buy them because they work, and we can show you they work. We've experimented on them in Gaza and Lebanon and Yemen and Syria. And to the utter eternal shame of our governments, they buy those weapons, and we say end that trade. Cancel every single contract with Israeli weapons manufacturers. Every single one of them. And as well, we've had some powerful evidence come out just in the last few months about how Australia is feeding weapons parts directly into Israel. And when we're up joining at the Rising Tide rally in Newcastle in a few weeks, let's make a side trip up to Williamtown. And let's get up there and protest the F-35 hub that is there in Williamtown. Because we found out from some courageous journalism from Declassified Australia that weapons parts for the F-35 fighter jet are being sent straight from Williamtown down here to passenger jets in Sydney Airport, and then flown to Nevatim Air Base in Israel to be put on F-35s in Israel. And not once or twice, but at least 70 times, straight from Australia, straight to Israel, to keep those fighter jets flying to deliver the bombs and the killings in Lebanon and Gaza and across the region. And do you know what? Those spineless, utterly abject group in federal parliament that call themselves Labor, do you know what they said about that? They said, we don't send weapons and weapons parts to Israel. And we showed them the evidence. And they said, oh no, that wasn't us. That weapons hub in Williamtown, it's owned and operated by the United States. Oh, and it was Lockheed Martin and Donald Trump who made the decisions to send weapons from Australia to Israel, and we're not responsible for it. What a craven surrender of everything it means to be Australia. To hand to the United States a weapons hub in Williamtown, to let it send weapons from Australia, many made in Australia, to Israel, and then for our government to say it's not their fault, it's not on their watch. Well, it is on their watch. It is on Australian territory. And we say shut the F-35 hub in Williamstown and shut every single US base on this country while we're at it. Every single one of them. And if you want to know why Donald Trump was so happy with Anthony Albanese the other day, it's because Anthony Albanese is building him an $8 billion nuclear submarine base that he wants up and running in 2027 off Perth, and has given the United States billions of dollars for their industrial base on the hope that we might get some nuclear subs. Our government is funding the US war machine. And when you take a step back and you ask yourself, why has our government not sanctioned the Netanyahu war cabinet? Why has our government continued to feed weapons and weapons parts into Israel. Why has our government not made the sanctions? The answer lies in our craven relationship with Washington, because we do what the United States tell them. Federal Labor, just like the coalition, do what Donald Trump or Joe Biden or whoever else in Washington tells them. And if we want Australia to be part of a global movement for a free Palestine, if we want to stop sending weapons parts into conflicts, if we want to stand up for human rights and stand against genocide, we need to cancel AUKUS, and we need to break those ties with Washington, and we need a genuinely independent foreign and defence policy. And let's start that movement, so let's build that movement and link the Free Palestine movement to the peace movement, to First Nations justice and to ending AUKUS, and let's make this movement change this country. Because if there's one thing I've seen, and I think we've all felt it, we bloody well need to change this country, don't we? And we need to change the leadership in this country, and we need to change the politics in this country, and we need to disentangle ourselves from the Israel, from any connection with Israel. Disconnect ourselves from the United States and its war plans, and make an independent Australia that stands for a peaceful world. And can I finish with this? Just 2 weeks ago, when we were in Senate estimates asking the AFP, the Australian Federal Police, what are you doing to prosecute war criminals that are coming back from the Israeli Defence Force and living amongst us? Have you commenced a task force? No, they haven't. Have you been looking at the social media posts where these people often celebrated their war crimes? No, they haven't. We need a permanent war crimes unit in Australia to track down war criminals amongst us. And we need to flood the Australian Federal Police on their hotline that they've put up with every piece of evidence we have of war criminals returning from Israel, because there should be no safe harbour for war criminals in this country. No safe harbour for war criminals in this country. Thank you for coming out again today. Thank you for committing, fundamentally committing, to a world which delivers a free Palestine. Thank you for standing out against genocide, and let's together change this country and change the world. Thanks very much.
What's taking place in Palestine is horrendous.
Here are some ways that you can keep yourself informed and involved.
Listen in to Palestine Remembered every Saturday morning at 9:30 a.m. or listen to the podcast.
Join the APAN mailing list at apan.org.au for updates, news about actions you can get involved in, and where you can donate to provide humanitarian assistance.
Listen to other news and current affairs programs on 3CR that also cover Palestine.
The oppression of the Palestinian people has been going on for 75 years. It has to stop. You can be part of making that happen by staying informed and active.
APAN is a proud supporter of 3CR.
We'll be right back.
you're back with Annie Tobiah and Anila on Solidarity Breakfast on 3CR, your community radio station. What was that?
That was Sydney band Raw Headache, now no longer together, but one of the best bands post-2000s. Very, very good band. I'd recommend their last album, High.
Well, it's great. It's great to listen to Australian music on 3CR, because that's what you realise is that there's some fantastic Australian performers out there. We're going to listen to an interview you did with someone from the UK who's involved in a union that deals in workers in the precarious industries.
Yeah, I interviewed Rema from the Independent Workers of Great Britain, which is a rank and file union that organises specifically, like you were saying, precarious workers. Rema organises drivers, but they organise the IWGB organisers.
Oh, you're just talking letters.
Bakeries, cafes, they organise some pretty hard to organise places and actually achieve some pretty amazing things. You can go on their website and see a list of their campaigns that they currently have active. Just give me a second to find it because I didn't put it on the thing properly.
Oh, you're a slacker.
Yeah, lovely bloke. We took him in.
Well, Rema, welcome. Yes, it's great to be here. Thank you.
Sorry.
Studios of 3CR. Do you want to tell our listeners a bit of who you are, what you do, and what it means for you to come to the other side of the world and meet people that are organising in similar ways?
Yeah, well, my name's Rema. I'm a member of the Independent Workers of Great Britain. I've been with them for 4 years. I'm an organiser for drivers. And our union basically organise and represent and try to activate gig economy workers such as cleaners, security guards, yoga teachers, cycling instructors, couriers. We have quite a few branches. We're a very active union. We believe in bottom-up type organisation and activating workers to improve their working conditions, but also to change society. I'm also I would call a revolutionary Pan-Africanist. So that's where I cut my teeth on understanding the world and having a certain view of the world that puts people before profit, and also that as a person of African descent, I understand that my dignity is wrapped around the unification of the African continent under a just social and economic system for Africans of home and abroad. So that quite easily fits into the work I'm doing at the moment in the union, and because I have the same philosophies and principles and understand the same objectives. So I have a dual kind of purpose.
Yeah, and I mean, that's what's been interesting as we talked. It's just like how many of the conditions that you guys are organising against are very similar conditions that exist here for workers to organise against as well.
Yeah, definitely. It's interesting, as you said, that the same conditions that are happening in the UK are happening here. We have a Labour government, for instance, which is going more to the right. We have a massive movement for supporting the Palestinian struggle and the genocide to stop the genocide in Gaza. We have an upsurge of racist and far right support, and the unions and those who are progressive and want advocate for freedom and democracy and justice. We need to come together and start to organise and build. So, I can see the similarities of what you're going through here and what's happening in the UK are totally the same, although there might be different nuances. The issues of racism are becoming worse. Various communities are being attacked, physically attacked. We had a situation a year or two ago where, they tried to burn down hotels where immigrants were being held, and these immigrants are coming from places like Iraq, from Syria, from Palestine, from West Africa, where imperialism or the system that controls the world and tries to in various brutal ways to control people, they're escaping wars and total devastation. So, you know, it's the same situation.
Well, it's funny you mentioned that because we also had refugees staying in hotels here, in indefinite detention centres in the centre of the city.
Yeah.
Hotels that would be otherwise viewed as luxurious views of the city were turned into no-go-out zones for illegally detained migrants that were not on a visa.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, the work that your union does is crucial in organising some of the most vulnerable workers in our society. What have been some of the strategies that you have seen succeed in the workplaces that you've organised?
Yeah, well, I can definitely talk from the from private hire driver situation. I'm an organiser for drivers, and we have this saying, driving alone, fighting together, no one left behind. As you know, when you're driving, you're alone. So we don't have a specific, as an organiser for driver, we don't have a specific place or a work area where we can all congregate. Drivers are usually, they drive by themselves, but they do congregate in car parks, mosques, cafes. And as the same as here, most of the drivers, I would say 98, 99% are either non-white or immigrant workers. So they have their own communities, their own WhatsApp groups. So we understand that the only way to build power and to build capacity is to engage, and to engage to build trust, to build confidence, and to, you know, build trust. And that's very important. So that's our strategy, is to create that situation, and also to do actions which are relevant to the workers. We had a number of actions this year that's really increased our membership. And also our activity of drivers getting involved. And we're now building a group of drivers that we're expanding all the time that want to go out there and be active. So we're continuing that strategy of engagement, activity, and then organising people and politically educating them to understand the steps and the process of actually building capacity and power.
Well, it's like we were saying before in the drive over here, was that actually you can't stop people from organising. And so the best work that we can all do as community organisations, as community radios, or as unions, is to give people the means to organise themselves and provide for them the structures into which they will succeed.
Absolutely. I mean, we want to, our philosophy is basically to obviously recruit into the union, but also to give people the tools and the confidence to organise themselves and to build relationships with communities and groups. Because I believe that the only way that we're going to move forward is when we collaborate with each other, we create united fronts, and we collaborate on things that we have in common. And there are so many things that the things that we have in common far outweigh the things that divide us. All communities are going through the same thing, maybe from different perspectives, but they are all very similar, and we need to find ways that we can work together.
Exactly right. And as we address previously, like the way the world is going, as the contradictions sharpen and we continue to exist under worsening neoliberal capitalist conditions, the need for community to be organized is only going to increase as the pressures of daily life. I mean, even the fact that we have accepted a term called cost of living is egregious enough to want to organize out of a system, out of that. And I think that's part of what brings us together today, is the need for internationalism, need to broaden this struggle in proportion to the global financial interests that control our daily lives.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've been absolutely blown away with meeting you and meeting other organisers, and it's just so easy to engage and interact and to, you know, push forward that whole aspect of solidarity and international solidarity. I'm here on holiday for a family sort of situation, for a wedding, but I thought it was important for me to take the time out to really link up with various people, various organizations, to understand what you're doing, to also, you know, share what we're doing in the UK, and to see how we can support each other and learn from each other, because I think that's very important. So, and part of one of our strategies was, or one of our activities, we actually were able to link up with drivers or unions in Nigeria, in Uruguay, and the United States, to do a log off. And we want to expand that. Maybe we'll have Australia in there as well. But not only just drivers, but as unions and as groups that are trying to improve people's working lives and to change society.
It's of no greater importance now.
Avanti o popolo alla riscossa,
Radio File,
presenta
the inaugural Gaetano Greco Memorial Symposium on Gramsci's Contemporary Relevance.
Hegemony, Resistance and the Modern Condition.
Interpreting Current Global Crises through Antonio Gramsci.
Tuesday, 11th November, 6:30 p.m. Solidarity Hall. $20 waged, $15 unwaged.
Speakers include Dr. Cole McNaughton, Zach Gillies-Palmer, and Dr. Elizabeth Humphreys.
Celebrate the legacy of our comrade Gaetano Greco and learn about Gramsci.
The event will be recorded on 3CR,
your anti-fascist
community radio.
Remember to tune in to Radio Filef every Wednesday at 6:30 p.m.
Non siate indifferenti, ci vediamo lì.
3CR Community Radio. Giving voice to the community since 1976.
And you're back with Annie and Debia and Anila on Solidarity Breakfast on your 3CR community radio station. And what was that fabulous music that we were listening to?
I don't speak Cyrillic. I don't know how to read Cyrillic. But I know that the band's called Kino. And it's incredible music to me. From the Soviet Union, they were much maligned. But then once the public heard them, they inspired a movement called Kinomania and became the best.
But it's even more amazing because the guys that were making that music were part of a Korean...
So the singer Victor Tsoi, his dad was he's ethnically Korean, born in the Soviet Union, part of a large cohort of ethnic Koreans that were living in the Soviet Union, just as a representation of how actually... vast and diverse the Soviet Union
and
was.
Real history is.
Yeah, and quite unified. So, I mean, I couldn't recommend enough the movie that Victor Tsoi was in just before he passed away called The Needle, just a really awesome 80s thriller from the Soviet Union. And maybe you guys can get into a bit of Kinomania yourselves and revisit the discography.
Oh, fantastic. We're going to go now to the anti-US imperialist gathering that was held last Saturday at the State Library in Melbourne. The Australian government has expelled the Venezuelan consul. And I realised that this was hot off the press when I was hearing about it on Saturday, because it doesn't seem to have entered the airwaves anywhere else.
Now, this little event's been organised by the Venezuela Solidarity Campaign, and I'm going to call up Chris Slee to speak on behalf of this organisation.
Over the past 2 months, the United States Navy has sunk 7 small boats in the Caribbean near the Venezuelan coast, killing 30 people. Recently, they also sank 2 boats off Colombia's Pacific coast, killing several more people. Now, Trump claims the victims were drug smugglers. There's no evidence for this whatsoever. And as Marie DeLora said, if they suspected the boats were carrying drugs, they could have stopped the boats and searched them. Instead, they just sank the boats and murdered the crews. Now, why is all this happening? It's part of their attack on Venezuela and also on Colombia. The United States has sent warships, planes and soldiers to the Caribbean ready to attack Venezuela. For more than 20 years, the US has been trying to overthrow the government of Venezuela, which was led by President Hugo Chavez from 1999 until his death in 2013, and is now led by Nicolas Maduro. The US has supported attempted coups. It has imposed an economic blockade, trying to prevent the Venezuelan government from participating in international trade. It not only bans US companies from dealing with the Venezuelan government, unless granted an exemption, it also tries to intimidate non-US companies into complying with the US embargo, threatening to punish them if they defy US orders. By sinking small boats off the coast of Venezuela, the US may be trying to provoke a response that would give a pretext for more attacks. These attacks might include bombing Venezuela, bombing the perhaps the capital or perhaps oil refineries or something, who knows. It may include commando raids, or it may include a naval blockade to physically prevent ships from entering Venezuelan ports. Trump has also made threats of military aggression against Colombia, as well as threatening other Latin American states. Why is the US doing this? Well, one motive is economic. The United States wants to control the natural resources of Latin American countries, such as Venezuela's oil. The US also wants to install governments that would follow a pro-US foreign policy. Venezuela and Colombia have been very critical of US policies in the Middle East, including support for Israel's genocide in Gaza. The US also wants to crush any moves towards progressive social change in Latin America. For example, the former President Chavez used Venezuela's oil wealth to fund free healthcare for the Venezuelan people. The US ruling class saw this as a bad example, since it might inspire people in the US to demand free healthcare. The blockade undermines Venezuela's healthcare system by making it difficult to obtain medicines, vaccines, and medical equipment. The US wants to undermine the confidence of Venezuelan people in their healthcare system. We call on the Australian government to condemn US attacks on Venezuela, Colombia, and other Latin American countries. Australia should support these countries when they take their complaints to the United Nations. Well, the Venezuelan people are resisting this aggression. They are joining the militia to fight against a potential invasion. So we stand with them in resisting US aggression. Long live the Venezuelan resistance. Thanks.
Marisol Salinas, she's from Chile, but also an indigenous person from that part of the world. She's represented the Latin American Solidarity Network, otherwise known as LASNET.
Thank you. I would like to acknowledge that the land where we are, the Burundi land, also my brothers and sisters, pay my respect to the elders past, present, and emerging. And also to leave clear that this land has never been ceded. Yes, my name is Marisol, and I'm Mapuche indigenous from Chile, from the south of Chile, but we are one nation, Chile and Argentina. While we are here today denouncing US imperialism, we see in the news, we can look, Google, whatever program you get the information from, and you can see what United States, what they are doing and what they are trying to do in Latin America. They cannot leave the countries to rule as the people choose, because we have democratic elections, and that's when governments get elected, with some exceptions like Ecuador now that is under United States hands. We have a few countries, you know, who are happy to be under United States hands, but the majority of Latin America, Central American countries, we want our freedom. We are fighting for our freedom. We indigenous people have been surviving more than 500 years fighting with different states, but we don't want United States imperialism to come into our land. We want our freedom, but we want to support Venezuela, we want to support Colombia, we want to support Cuba, we want to support Nicaragua and any country in Latin America that at the moment has been threatened by United States imperialism. Who? We have Marco Rubio, who is the person, and a Cuban who went to United States with lies about his past, saying that he was coming, he and his family, running from Fidel Castro. His family ran before when Batista was in Cuba. Lies. This is the people who lie over and over. You have Trump lying all the time, everywhere. He thinks he's the king of the lies. And people tolerate that behavior. What kind of world we are living at the moment? A world of lies, where the biggest liar is the most important person. This is the world. And we need to fight against that, because we believe in humanity. We believe in democracy. When we talk about democracy, we talk about everyone has the right to choose and decide how you want to live your life. And that's why we want people who are listening. Yes, support the Venezuelan people. Don't judge. Don't believe all the lies coming from the imperial, in this case, United States and other countries. This is just for you to laugh, as we laughed before. Corina Machado, someone who has been supporting two coups d'etat in Venezuela got the Peace Prize. Can you believe that? So that's the kind of people, that's how the world is working at the moment. You are killing people, you will win the Nobel Prize for peace. That's how it works. What we can do, normal people like us, exercise our right to come and protest, denounce, use all the media that is that you have access, denounce what United States are doing. Denounce what is happening in Latin America. We are asking you to support the Latin American people, indigenous.
Join us for a vibrant celebration of music, culture, and community.
We're hosting a Peña, the right to live in peace, an evening dedicated to the life and legacy of Chile's beloved folk singer, Victor Jara.
Enjoy live music, dance performances, and delicious food and drinks.
This is a fundraiser for Olive Kids, supporting the children of Palestine.
Join us Saturday, November 1st.
MUA Hall, 46 Island Street, West Melbourne.
Doors open at 4:30 p.m. Tickets just $10 at the door.
Bring cash.
Bring cash.
Bring cash.
Come and share in the music, the stories, and the spirit of solidarity.
Nos vemos there, compañeros.
A 3CR supporter.
That's right. Bring cash tonight, MUA. You heard it here.
On 3CR Community Radio on Solidarity Breakfast. And we're going to move to their last report, which was centres on the stuff that's going on at Melbourne City Council. But you might have noticed that it's also spread to Footscray Council as well. The last week we were talking about the idea of the City Council, Melbourne City Council, bringing in what they call community safety officers, but are really security, private security, and increasing the amount of security cameras, basically focusing on the unhoused people and other types of people that they consider to be unruly on the streets. And they were presented a whole range of lived experience of people who were affected by the community security officers. And at last meeting on the 21st of October, on the 28th, the council was having their meeting to pass or amend elements of their four-year plan. So outside, the council officers had a word with Olivia Ball, who's a dissenting councillor, and then we're going to go on to hear a report from Danielle, who is part of the Save Public Housing Collective. If you want to catch up with what Save Public Housing Collective are doing, you should go to their Instagram for updates on the Public Housing Towers Frontline Action Group, call-outs and daily solidarity. But she did the hard yard. She sat in on the meeting and she gives us an account of what actually happened. We're down here in front of the town hall and there's a very important vote going on tonight, isn't there?
That's right, Annie. My name's Olivia Ball. I'm a councillor on Melbourne City Council. And tonight it is the final vote that we've all been anticipating about whether the council plan, which is the one major document that any council adopts in each term of council, encompassing everything that a council does, which is a huge, huge broad range of things. We adopt this plan once every term, which is once every 4 years. And of course, this council has been trialling security guards over the last 8 months, and that remains in the plan that is on in the meeting papers that have been published for tonight. It could be amended, and I will try to amend it to remove the security guard program, and we will see in the chamber what happens tonight to that amendment and the overall council plan.
Now, last week there was an enormously long meeting where the voices of people affected by that security plan who live on the streets had their voices heard. Do you feel that that had an effect?
Oh, I can only speak for myself, Annie. It had an enormous effect on me. And I know other people were very affected by it. The critical people we need to wonder about is those who have a vote in tonight's decision. There are 11 councillors. I think they were all present last week and heard that testimony. Over 2 hours of first-person, powerful testimony about the impact that the security guards are having on people on the streets of Melbourne. I found it profoundly moving and extraordinary. And it's a huge credit to the Homeless Persons Union and anyone and everyone who organised it to get together and make those statements and make that important representation to council, because council must hear about the impact of its work, its decisions and its programs and how they impact the people of Melbourne.
Now the council is made up of 11 councillors, as you say, and there's a lot more people who actually live in the city than in the past, isn't that right? Like the makeup of the people who vote for the council includes commercial interests as well as many more residential people, isn't that right?
Yes. Election at the City of Melbourne is different from other councils in Victoria. All councils in Victoria allow landlords to vote. So hypothetically, if you owned a property in the 79 different local government areas in Victoria, you could vote 79 times. It's anathema to democracy that people with property get to vote more often than people without. It doesn't happen at any other level of government. One vote attaches to one person. However, that's true in local government, and again, in the City of Melbourne, there's an added difference. In this municipality alone, businesses vote twice. So that means, of course, that the business vote is doubled relative to any resident. And in my view, businesses shouldn't be voting at all. Businesses don't vote for state government or federal government. Why do they vote for councils?
The other thing is that a city like Melbourne, a city council represents a sort of, it's a flagship, you know, public facing sort of different kind of council, isn't it? You know, it represents a city that's international in its presence, isn't it?
You could say that, yeah. A capital city council is the centre of the major metropolis, and it's very high profile in that regard. It's Lord Mayor as the leader of this city. Doesn't change every year like other councils do. He is directly elected by the people for 4 years, and he is the figurehead who's on the media every single day. That's not true of mayors throughout the suburbs and the shires. It does have a unique quality, being the capital city council, same as the City of Sydney, City of Brisbane, City of Perth and so forth. Those capital city councils, they have more resources, and we're expected to set a higher standard, and we like to be standard setters. And unfortunately, in a negative sense, people, other councils might want to follow what the City of Melbourne does. If the City of Melbourne's doing it, we should do it too, or why can't we do it too? And so that is a real risk with a program like this that I know other councils are looking to emulate in.
Well, the other thing about it is that surveillance, which is not just private security, but an increase in surveillance cameras, there's a belief that this is a security method, but in actual fact, statistically, it doesn't stop bad behaviour.
No.
It just observes it.
You're 100% right. If CCTV and surveillance cameras stopped crime, we wouldn't have any crime. The crime rate in Melbourne would have dwindled as the technology was improved and increased and expanded across our city. It would have just wiped out crime, because the CBD, certainly, there is no place in the public realm where you're not seen on a video camera, which is monitored in real time here inside Melbourne Town Hall. So if it were true that cameras prevented crime, we wouldn't have any crime, which is clearly a preposterous idea. Cameras have a useful role in detecting and solving crime, but they do not prevent crime, so let's not fool ourselves. What prevents crime is, well, a whole lot of other things. And what I would like to see the City of Melbourne doing is what's known as justice reinvestment, is not taking a law and order approach, and frankly, wasting millions of dollars on moving around people around our city and not solving any problems. And of course, I don't want to equate homeless people with crime. That is a false analogy.
Well, it's about being untidy.
Yes.
Untidiness.
Yes.
It's very sort of bourgeois kind of concept,
yes,
isn't it?
Yes. Let's think about who is safe, who is actually safe and who actually feels safe, and what are these measures intended to do? Who are they intended to protect or frankly pander to?
And homeless people deserve to be safe as well.
Of course they do.
And they are, who is most at risk on our streets? It's not middle class people walking past something they might find threatening or unsavoury. It's people sleeping rough, people escaping family violence and encountering violence on the streets. We know the life expectancy of people living on the streets and homeless is so much lower than the rest of the population. It is a health hazard, it is a lethal risk, and it is a place of unsafety for people who are in that position through no fault of their own and cannot avoid it.
They also say that cities like Melbourne have services. So, you know, hiding away the homelessness or sending people to far-flung places is actually removing them from the services and the safety that they're seeking.
Well, yeah, that's true. To the extent that we provide services here, people, but even if we didn't, people have a right to exist. We're not treating everyone as equal if we think that if you have a home in the city of Melbourne, you have a right to be here. But if you don't have a home, you don't have a right to be here.
Yeah.
It's fundamentally treating unhoused people as less than. And I, of course, I don't hold that view, and I find it very, very troubling. Yeah, I'm very glad you asked me about whether security cameras affect crime, because...
I know they don't.
Yeah.
Personal experience, I was covering a demonstration a number of years ago up near Collins, atop of Collins Street. The critical response police pushed me over. I was just standing there doing my coverage,
yeah.
And they pushed me over and broke my arm. And you'd think that a place like that would have had lots of cameras and that I should have had a public, a legal result, but I got no result over that. So I know cameras don't work in that regard.
And it certainly didn't prevent what happened to you.
Yeah,
but right. I'm glad you mentioned that, actually, because that is another thing, since you asked, that I'm very concerned about in this plan, is the intention of this council to limit our right to peaceful protest. That is in this version of the council plan, and again, I'll be moving an amendment to remove that provision in the council plan, because I'm very concerned that there are already huge encroachments on the right to peaceful protest by the state government, and I don't want to see any additional limitations on our right to protest. It's fundamental to democracy, and no government should be in the position of deciding who can protest when and where. I mean, it's anathema.
Well,
to
the other week, there was the bikes race from the bay to and then there was the marathon. Everything got dislocated. It's okay to dislocate everybody for a sports event.
The opening of a makeup store in Bourke Street Mall.
Yeah,
the
it was
trams,
okay.
The trams were stopped to open a department store.
Yeah, well, there you go.
For commercial interests, fine.
Yeah.
But for democratic interests, it's so fundamentally important in a democracy that we can all express our views and come together in public places to join together and express those views. How else between elections can we tell the government how we feel about what they're doing? I can't support these limitations that are being proposed, and I certainly hope they fail tonight.
This is a rapacious expansion of privatisation, which is going to change the face of the city that we live in.
It's not share, it's not making the housing crisis go away. It's really about the big end of town. It's a shame job.
It's a transfer. It's a theft of public wealth, which is going to worsen the housing crisis.
The government is giving public land to private developers. Why would you do that? Why would you give all these assets over to the biggest bully in town?
We're looking down to a future that we don't know what's going to happen. Where are we going to get moved to? Dandenong? Or away from our communities and away from the services that we need.
This is a line in the sand for not only the public housing tenants, but for a Victorian society. So how long did the meeting go for on the 28th?
It was a 4-hour meeting.
Okay, and what was your feeling about it?
My feeling was that there's essentially two progressive councillors and a block of nine from moderate to right of moderate to hard right, who would in one breath like to talk up their commitment to, looking after those frontline services and giving money to, that helps those who are vulnerable in the community, in their words, and at the same time vote down a proposed amendment that emphasised the commitment of human rights in the MCC's four-year plan. So there was like five proposed amendments, which I think are relevant, and in the way they played out kind of showed this block of nine where they could support, say there was one amendment that asked them to increase Indigenous species and report state and national extinct species of animals within the city.
Yep.
And the nine could support that amendment, but they couldn't support one in regards to humanity and people who are at risk of, you know, living unhoused or homelessness or that. Yeah. So, you know, that was the thing that played out. And then there was an amendment by one of the, I'd say in the block of nine conservatives that proposed. So Councillor Camillo proposed an amendment that would emphasise councils' commitment to monitoring the bail law reforms by the state government. And so just in perspective of the amendments, then, you know, the two that were voted down was, or three actually, but two which are relevant to this issue, is that Councillor Olivia Ball had proposed to add the emphasis of human rights and commitment to human rights. And the other one that she proposed was to remove all references to security guards, which are actually called community safety officers, from the plan and cancel the use of them. So in between her proposing those amendments, which were voted down by that nine, there was Councillor Camillo proposing that they watch bail law reform. And what was interesting is there was a lot of talk and fluff about how we already are obliged to support human rights, so we don't have to explicitly say it, those things aren't relevant. Someone even said things in other territories across the world aren't relevant here, and if it's in state or federal law, we have to adhere to those things anyway. And so they used that to vote down Olivia's amendment. But then it was also said that, well, the bail reforms the state government and we don't actually have to explicitly say it. But the CEO told the councillors, well, it's up to you what you'd like to emphasise your commitment to. And so the nine all voted for this emphasis of monitoring safety and bail law thing. And so there was this in Councillor Camillo's proposal about this bail law thing, it was to do with increased crime, but he didn't connect his proposition to actually the continuing progress and monitoring of bail reforms. Like, he just said, I rattled off some statistics about how Melbourne City Council had this huge percentage of increased crime, and it was the most in any Australian capital. And but he was also conflating like extreme crimes of stabbing and someone, an out of control driver through a pedestrian precinct, but not actually connecting or even stating whether the majority, like, so there was no
clarification. So they were very extreme examples.
Yeah, but in the statistics doesn't say if they're petty crimes, if they're poverty induced, and yes. Then the measures that City of Melbourne are rolling out, which this week they've just got their Instagram saying, you know, the new safety officers started today, yesterday.
With their big grin on their faces, like they're nice guys, yeah?
Yeah.
But they were wearing stab jackets.
Yeah, so they're dressed like cops. They've got cameras on them. But what I was going to say is that there's the measures they're putting in place to enforce local laws on essentially what would be petty, what we're thinking is probably mostly petty crimes. And then they're over-conflating this with like bail laws, repeat offenders. And the implication when he was talking about his proposition was like they were going to work towards excluding people from the geographic area of City of Melbourne.
Yes, so, you know, so he's only looking at major crimes, but he's actually connecting them to getting rid of people that he obviously believes are antisocial.
Yeah, so well, the Melbourne City Action is going to enforce and add to those crime statistics, which will, and the way Camillo was talking, was potentially try and start banning people geographically from the City of Melbourne, which would cut people off from support services and community and, you know, things they need, if in fact they are one of these, like, repeat offending for antisocial behaviour. But there's no
clarification. So that sounds like they're going to create a list of antisocial behaviour people. Is that right?
Well,
they haven't said that, but that's what they'll have to do. Yeah. The other thing is, did they decide that they were going to put the increased amount of cameras in the CBD?
Yeah, that was part of the plan. Tuesday night was really just proposed amendments at the last gasp of this council.
So that they were already cemented.
They've already cemented all the camera stuff.
Yep. Which, and what about the stuff to do with public protest? Was there any mention of that?
So Councillor Ball proposed an amendment, I believe that was her amendment to remove that protest plan, whatever it was, got voted down by that 9 as well.
Ah, right. Interesting. All right, so there's a conclave of 9 conservative councillors that have the Melbourne City Council by the scruff of its neck.
From what I understand, there's like a block of four, which was like Team Reese, and they had
Team Reese. That Team sounds Reese. Like something from one of those.
So the mayor's name is Nick Reese, and on his election ticket was also 3 other councillors, Rashina Campbell, Kevin Louie, Mark Scott, and on their promises was this introduction of the safety CSOs. So they're following through on, an election promise, but they still have to negotiate. They don't actually have – they can't vote down the whole council. They still have to negotiate with the others, but sense was that the other 5 are even more conservative than them. They're kind of like, I'd say, the moderate right. But together they vote down, these humane propositions, mostly from these 2 who I would consider the progressives, Councillor David Griffiths and Councillor Olivia Ball.
All right, so we're going to now see 4 years of this, and we'll keep an eye. It's a watching brief on what they consider to be their successes. Did they have any idea about what their success would be?
They didn't put in KPIs, but there was this kind of repeated thing that this is just plans. It doesn't actually mean, we can adjust them and or amend them, when they were kind of trying to.
But they've committed millions of dollars to these changes.
Yeah. I think they said it was like an $800 million plan.
$800 million.
Well, it's $2 million for the $2 million for the safety officers.
Yep.
Which is 11, according to their social media on Thursday, the 11 people have been trained, and 2 of them are women and the rest are men.
And they've already trained them up, so
they're all dressed up. They're started.
Yeah, and
Thursday.
So they weren't already. So this meeting about
it was on Tuesday.
Yeah, this. Yeah, which means
so
of course
they
would already.
Pulled it,
yeah,
but they didn't.
But
yeah, and the election promise of that Team Reese 4 people apparently was that they'd have 30 officers. This is what I've heard, and that the even harder right people are, up in arms because there's only 11 safety officers, not 30 as they promised. So this is already,
A bit of friction amongst the right.
Yeah. And the other thing was, I guess, that the more conservative right-wing ones were sort of voicing their discontent and frustration that this element of security guards and officers had taken up so much time of their meeting time for months on end, when it's only, you know, $2 million of a $800 million plan is what they were saying. And then it's like, but there's no acknowledgement. The reason that has taken up so much time is because it's about human rights and, you know, self-determination of someone who is houseless, whether they choose that or not.
Yeah, understood. Yeah. So what they're trying to say is that human rights and the unhomed people are a waste of time, and it's their fault. They like to. It's a bit like a bit like abusers. I mean, I'm not saying they are abusers, but it's a bit like domestic violence abusers. They say, "Look what you made me do."
Yeah, I think. Look, yeah, there's no acknowledgement of this. It's just the systems they're creating and enforcing is at the street level. The result, they're criminalising poverty, which is from state and federal government neglect. Between the governments, definitely this is what you made me do. Now we're going to. But, I mean, I try not to go down that dark rabbit hole, but, like, it does look pretty scary if this is the trend of locking up people instead of providing services and,
And having a more enlightened view of human interaction.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much for giving us a breakdown of what happened on Tuesday.
No worries, Annie. Thanks for having me.
She sounds awesome.
Yeah, well, that was great. And that was Danielle, and she sat through that long meeting and gave us the benefit of her account of what actually happened. And she is part of the Save Public Housing Collective. So go to Instagram for updates on the Public Housing Towers, Frontline Action Group, Callouts and Daily Solidarity.
And we had a pretty comprehensive program all today, so if you want to turn all that emotion into action, tonight you can go to the MUA headquarters from 4 p.m. till 10 p.m. There'll be an evening with the Chilean community raising funds for the Palestinian-run organization Olive Kids. Tomorrow at 12 p.m. at the State Library, you can go to the Palestine rally. As we know, as we reported on at the start of the program, this is not peace, end the occupation and disarm Israel. On Monday, you can go to the forum to protest against the Israeli Psytrance duo that raises funds for the IDF infected mushroom. Be careful when you go there. The thugs in the Lions of Zion have done a counter protest, so be on your watch. Then on Thursday at Vic Trades Hall, 6th of November from 6:15 p.m. there will be Voices Under Fire, Stories from Gaza, A Night to Hear Poetry, Testimony from Gaza and the Palestinian Community. And then after that, there'll be Solidarity Breakfast next week on Saturday morning.
And coming up next is Asia Pacific Currents.
We'll go out with Will Oldham. I am goodbye. Thank you.
Goodbye.
Bye.
You are hello, a glowing cry. Heaven we go, never say die. I'll likely never know the answer why. You are hello, I am goodbye. I am goodbye, like the end of something. Sometimes, like the way that a wound up toy top unwinds, I am goodbye, I am goodbye.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au. You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.